It was the women who went with Jesus all the way to the cross. The men were not totally shamed. One of them went too. And it was to a woman that Jesus mysteriously revealed himself. When all seemed hopeless, when the apostles for fear had run away, and when all they could think of doing was to grieve over his death. And Mary Magdalene, who loved him dearly, could think of nothing other to do than to cry. And mysteriously, and that is the mystery we have come this morning to celebrate, she met the Jesus she so dearly loved. It would be utterly presumptuous for me or for anybody else to pretend that we understand the mystery. Words cannot encompass it. We can only try somehow to enter into it. The theologians, through the years ever since, have debated the meaning of the resurrection. Was this physically and really the same Jesus that they met again? Or was it an extraordinary inner experience that was real? We will never know the answer to that mystery, not on this side of eternity, and it doesn't matter. In this case, the theologians had best be silent. But what we do know is that little hopeless band of people who had lost in every sense of the word, were remarkably revitalized and given hope. And it is that hope that we come to celebrate this morning. In his ministry, there was already the recognition that that little band of Jews, whom we call the first Christians, Jews like Jesus himself, were terribly afraid of what they were doing. And following this young radical rabbi who fell foul of the powers of religion, of the temple authorities, and of the powers of the state, the Roman Empire, no less. And between them, the religious and the secular authorities saw in this radical prophet who tried to bring alive the insights of the prophets of ancient Israel, they saw in him and in his challenge to widen out God's love to the whole of humanity and to say, no, 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 it is not just us Jews that God loves and wants to save, but our neighbors, whom we often see as our enemies. This Jesus was an affront to national and religious pride. And what do you do with such people? You imprison them, or you kill them. It's gone on like that ever since. It was like that before. The prophets were hounded and are hounded in the world today. If you want triumph from love, you're in trouble. The early church was in trouble. It was a time of martyrdom. It wasn't just Jesus they killed. It's gone on ever since. But the remarkable thing is that the words of Jesus were beginning to come true. When they were disheartened, Jesus turned to his disciples and said, "Do not be afraid, little flock. It is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Jesus preached the kingdom. Jesus lived the kingdom. But it was totally unlike the kingdoms of our world. It was not about exercising power over other people. It was humbly, graciously, gladly serving them, all of them, indiscriminately. "Fear not, little flock," although there's good reason to fear. "The Father will give you the kingdom." The reign of God in the hearts of his people. Who are his people? The whole human family, no less. And there are signs of the reign of God in his people with every act of love, with everything that is positive and creative. And this, that is at war with hatred and the abuse of power, the way we use our power to dominate other people. We do it personally, and we do it socially, we do it politically, again and again and again. And the remarkable thing that happened was that that little dissident group of Jews somehow had a message that was so transforming that within a relative short period of history, they actually won. They actually, from being tiny persecuted minority, became the majority until the day when the emperor himself, the Roman emperor, embraced Christianity. Was that good news? I'm afraid it wasn't. It was bad news. Because now the same would happen to Christianity as had happened to the Jewish temple. It was now in power. And ever since then, the history of the Christian church has been a betrayal of what Jesus really stands for. What did Christendom, as it described itself, the culture to which we are heir, what did it do? It turned on the Jews and persecuted them. It went to war in great crusades with the cross in front and massacred the people of Islam in the name of God. Yes, triumphant Christianity was the very opposite of what Jesus stood for. The Jesus who was born in obscurity, who died alongside other criminals, and who just as obscurely was present again, present only to those who loved him. If this Jesus had wanted to re-establish himself as the new king, the great liberator, he could easily, if the resurrection is true, he could easily have confronted the high priests and then confronted Caesar and said, "See, you killed me, and you didn't. Here I am. I've taken over." Nothing of the kind. Love does not dominate. Love is not about power, not about the big battalions that triumph in the world. It is hidden. It is obscure. And yet, it is the expression of a different kind of power. It is liberating. It sets those who experience it free to be what God has made them to be, and not subservient to the powers of the financial markets and the powers of the military systems, but just the power of love. It remains the faith in the last resort of those who have seen this Jesus. It's great to see a great crowd in this church today, but we know perfectly well that we who are here this morning are just a tiny fragment of the people of Auckland, and the Christians are an even tinier fragment of the people of our world. Because it's not about majorities. It's about something much more mysterious and in the end, much more worthwhile. Easter, new life. Well, it's the celebration within us of a new world. And I suppose the only contact many people in Auckland have is when they go into their supermarket. I don't know what was in the mind of the creators of the New World Supermarket when they gave it that title. But they were doing something quite significant, even if they didn't know it. Because a supermarket is indeed a kind of symbolic place where the riches of our world can be bought, can be had, can be shared. But our supermarkets are not accessible to the vast majority of the human race. The great majority would not know how to handle a supermarket. It would be beyond their ken. They would be glad just to have enough to eat for their children. But often, there is not enough. So the supermarket indeed becomes the symbol of the world that could be and should be a radical economic transformation of our world, where its riches are accessible to everyone. That kind of freedom. But the kind of freedom that Jesus gives cannot be taken away. And the hungry, the marginalized, those who are hated by others, are welcome into the fellowship of the kingdom. I want to take you this morning with me to Russia, because there is no tradition within the church that has understood the meaning of Easter as well as the Eastern Orthodox tradition, that is deeply rooted in the Russian culture and the Russian people. To them, Easter eggs are more than bits of chocolate. They are the symbol of new life. And I had the privilege often, in the years of the Cold War, as a Western guest, to share the life of the Russian churches in a country where officially God had been declared to be dead and indeed non-existent. And yet, the few churches that were allowed to open on Easter Sunday were crowded so that the people spilled out into the streets as they declared that Christ is risen. They have a sense of drama that we've lost. The Russian Orthodox Church is a great theater, a great place of music, of bringing heaven down to earth symbolically. It's laden with gold, and there you see the icons that speak of eternity. The people may not understand it intellectually, but they certainly understand it emotionally. For a moment, they capture heaven, and the world around them was often very sad and very tragic. I was once with a group of young English trade unionists on a visit to Russia, and our hosts were the Young Communist League. And we had a busy program, but it didn't, of course, it didn't include anything to do with religion. But when there was a bit of free time, I asked around, is there a church somewhere here? And the town was called Kalinin. Is there a church somewhere here? And most of the people didn't even know. But they said, in that direction, if you go on walking to the edge of town, I think you'll find one. So one night, it was midsummer, so it wasn't dark, I started walking through this strange Russian town, and I don't speak Russian, or just a few words, and went on walking and went on walking, hoping that I'd find it. And in the end, I did. A small, rather humble church was apparently the only open church in Kalinin. And I knocked on a door near the church in the hope that someone would open and I would find someone who belonged to the church. And a woman opened. God seemed to be on my side at that moment, because she spoke fluent German, which I do too. And she said, yes, I'm a Christian, but I'm not the priest's wife. The priest lives in that house. And I said to her, does he speak English or German? And she said, no. And I said, well, will you come with me? Because you can translate for me. So she came with me. So we knocked at the door of the priest's house. And we started a conversation that went on till about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he told his story. He told the story of a life, most of which had been spent in prison. He spent years in what has become called the Gulag. And eventually, he was set free and able again to minister in a church. And I was the first visitor from outside Russia he had ever met. To him, it was an extraordinary occasion to meet a priest from England. And at the end of that long conversation, and it was often a humorous conversation, he had not lost his sense of humor, his sense of fun, his sense of the world being a good place. He went to a cupboard in the corner of the room and he brought out his priest's cross. And he said, "This is such a special day for me. I want you to have it." And I said, and he made plain to me that that cross had been with him through the years of imprisonment. And I said to him, "Look, I can't take it. It must remain yours." And he laughed and said, "Oh, but I'm an archpriest now. I've got a better cross." And so he made me take it. I took it home, treasured it, but I never wore it. And then, one day, my other concerns for freedom and liberation took me to South Africa. And there, an Anglican priest, his name is John, found himself in prison for his struggle against apartheid. This time I knew where that cross belonged. I made sure that he got it in prison. The cross that stands for the hope we celebrate today went from the Gulag to a prison in South Africa. And today it's worn by Bishop John, who's not an archpriest, but a bishop. And it's the Russian cross that he wears as his bishop's cross. That is about suffering and redemption and hope. South Africa and Russia have gone through a period of revolution, but it's still the same world. In both places, a world of corruption and poverty and suffering. On the face of it, God does not reign any more now than then. The capitalist world is just as corrupt as the communist world was, and as the Roman world was in which Jesus lived. On the face of it, nothing has changed. And yet, everything has changed if you realize the power of love. If you realize, however imperfectly, what this kingdom is about, that sets us free to be ourselves, to be alongside Jesus, those he calls my friends. So quite humbly, and yet gloriously, and it is glorious this morning, just like the Russian church is a great theater, a theater of the divine, so we've got to see the church as a great theater of life, a theater in which tragedy and comedy are played out. We're not very good at it. We're not very good at turning this place into a real theater of performance of death and life symbolically that we can then take into life really. We've got to learn to do that. The Russians are better at it than we are. And I've been grateful every time worshiping with a Russian congregation. Yes, the theater of life that the church at its best can actually be, symbolizing the world that is not yet and yet has already come. There is the contradiction. The kingdom that lies in God's future and is already present within us now. We're not very demonstrative people of our sort of British, if it is, culture. And New Zealanders are sort of part of that still. But I'm going to make you be a bit more demonstrative now. I'm going to ask you to transform yourself in your imagination into a Russian congregation and to behave like they do. Because when they proclaim that Christ is risen, they really sort of take the roof off the church. And I'm going to get you to do it in Russian, in the ancient Russian of the Russian liturgy. It goes like this. Christos voskrese. The priest sings. And all the people respond, Vo istinu voskrese, Vo istinu voskrese, which means he is risen indeed. And they do it to each other on the street. Christos voskrese. And the answer is, Vo istinu voskrese. They had to whisper it for much of the time. But in church, it's not whispered. And it goes on and on like a great wave. Not once, not twice, once, thrice, but 20 times. And it gets louder and louder. I'm going to get you to do it. Get up. Just to help you to remember it. I say, Christos voskrese. Christos voskrese. And you reply, Vo istinu voskrese. Vo istinu voskrese. Christos voskrese. Christos voskrese. Christos voskrese. Christos voskrese. Christos voskrese. Christos voskrese.